Hey, everybody. This is The Takeaway. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry. And today, we're revisiting the very first deep dive here on The Takeaway. Now, we had this conversation back in 2021, and it was the first time that we brought this kind of extended conversation to The Takeaway. So we picked up a big topic, the phenomenon of political cruelty. Listening back to this one just might get me a little sentimental, because this was the first time my friend and colleague, Dorian Warren, joined me for our deep dive series. Dorian is the co-president of Community Change, the co-chair of the Economic Security Project, and he and I have co-hosted multiple media projects over the years. And we really wanted to tackle this issue of political cruelty.
I'm thinking of cruelty as an importantly civic phenomenon. You know, one thing I was trying to get my head around was I was really interested in the pleasure happening at Trump rallies. The sort of pleasure in saying outrageous things and the pleasure in cheering on these visions of causing physical violence or pain to different populations, particularly different non-white populations.
That's Christina Beltran, associate professor in the Department of Social and Cultural Analysis at New York University. And Melissa, as you know, she's the author of Cruelty as Citizenship, How Migrant Suffering Sustains White Democracy. And she helped us to think about cruelty differently than we're accustomed to thinking. Now, most of us, most of the time, tend to think of cruelty as individual actions motivated by personal hatreds. But Beltran offered us a definition of civic and political cruelty.
And I gotta say, I was so struck that Beltran's interest in cruelty was prompted by seeing and hearing what was happening at rallies for Donald Trump.
Correct Islam. Political
correctness. Amen. Right on.
Build that wall. You don't come and talk about America when you're deported.
Get the out of here.
Back in 2016, when all that was first starting to happen and Trump was running for president, I was leading a bipartisan cohort of Wake Forest University students. It was a year-long program called Wake the Vote, and we traveled together to many of the early primary states. We worked for political campaigns, and we went to public rallies and events for all the presidential candidates from both political parties, including rallies for Donald Trump. Now, to be clear, this was a diverse, multiracial, multi-faith cohort of students. So I talked with Zach Bynum. Now, he's the Takeaway's digital editor, but I first met him years ago when he was part of Wake the Vote. And Zach is a queer Black man who identifies as politically progressive. We talked about his experiences in 2016.
I remember that there was a bit of an air of darkness. And I say that just as someone because when I looked around, didn't see too many people who looked like me, didn't see too many people who were kind of like excited. It seemed like people were very, very angry, almost like vengeful.
And it wasn't just Trump rallies. See, Zach also vividly remembered a particular South Carolina primary rally for Senator Ted Cruz.
It was an uncomfortable environment. Mm-hmm. In my mind, like, I don't know how we all got through that moment, but I just remember there was a point in time where we were with one of our staff members who is a gay Muslim. And immediately we started talking about, you know, well, Ted Cruz starts talking about, you know, how all the things that God ordained and all these things that the left is trying to do with gay marriage and abortion and this, this, and that. And then also still pivoting to that talking point about terrorism. And I just remember looking at the staff member and being like, this is someone who, in my heart, like, has done nothing but shown us love, protection, and genuine empathy, and he knows that a lot of us are nothing alike. And to see him get a moment of just, like, scared and anxiety, it, like, really hurt me. And so, I remember that moment because that was powerful for me.
Melissa, Zachary's reflections here are, in many ways, a perfect illustration of this issue of civic cruelty. And Zachary remembers seeing the fear in his kind, empathetic staff leader and realizing just how cruel this political space had become as they were standing there. And this is exactly what Christina Beltran told us about how cruelty operates as a system.
So thinking about the fact that these sort of descriptions and sometimes then real enactments of cruelty made people feel like they were free. It made people feel like they were powerful. And it made them feel like they were part of a community of people. So it was, so this kind of cruelty. And I think when you think about things like the history, I turn to Ida B. Wells and talk about, you know, early white riots and some of the different civic disturbances, lynch mobs, and not even lynch mobs, but simply, you know, public hangings that happened when before we sort of outlawed public hanging, and those sort of spectacles of violence. Those spectacles were not just there to sort of just be cruel. They were also there to sort of tell us who we were as a people and what we stood for and our belief systems. And I think when you start thinking about cruelty as something that's also civic, you start to realize that those enactments make people feel like they are defending their country, that they are fighting for a better future, that they are enacting the kind, that they are able to, because they believe so strongly in the law, they're able to be the law.
Christina Beltran gives us two critical insights here. She reminds us that civic cruelty did not begin with President Trump. Cruel, forced divisions are, of course, a marker of many eras of American history. Enslavement is a practice of intergenerational cruelty. And after the end of slavery, the brutality of lynch mobs and the policy violence of segregation together ensured that formerly enslaved Black people could not join the body politic as full Americans. And I was especially interested that Beltran describes this cruelty as being definitive of the law itself. So even if using lynch mobs to keep Black people from voting or owning property might have been technically illegal, it was actually fully within another version of law, that is, a law of forced racial hierarchy. And Melissa, all this got me thinking about another writer who has outlined this idea of cruelty, Adam Serwer.
What I'm talking about really goes back to the founding of the country. You know, you have a country where you say all are created equal, but you sever a tremendous amount of the people from the country to that ideal.
Adam is a staff writer for The Atlantic, and he published an incredible new book titled The Cruelty is the Point, The Past, Present, and Future of Trump's America. Here's Adam on C-SPAN's Book TV in July.
It really applies to white men with property. It doesn't apply to Black people. It doesn't apply to the enslaved. It doesn't really apply to women as they meant it at the time. So justify that, you have to come up with reasons for why these blessings that you say are the right of all humanity, why a certain segment of humanity is not entitled to them.
Okay, Dorian. So I get it. I see the connection you've made here. One of the things he writes about is this spectacle of public cruelty that, I mean, gosh, for me, it remains one of the most painful that I've ever encountered. It's this famous photograph from 1930 Indiana. Two Black men, Thomas Shipp and Abram Smith, have been lynched. We can see in the photograph their bodies still hanging from the trees. And there's a crowd milling around at their feet. They're young and old, men, women, and children. And I'm always so surprised because they're not ashamed. They're looking directly at the camera. But maybe most shocking, the hardest to see, is that in the foreground of the photo, there's this young couple, and they're kind of holding hands and smiling. And there's something about the way their fingertips meet that is such an intimate and familiar gesture. Like, I remember reaching for my husband James, for his hand in the same way, the first time that we saw the Eiffel Tower together. But this couple in the photo, they're sharing this moment of awe and tenderness while witnessing the brutal murder of Black men. And I've seen the photo dozens of times. I teach it sometimes in class. It's even the photo that inspired the song Strange Fruit. Blood on the leaves. But I do not know what to do with it. With how it makes me feel, or even what it means about the depths of cruelty.
So white democracy is the idea that in the United States, our form of democracy allowed white citizens to rule themselves democratically while imposing tyranny on a non-white majority. And I think that's important because what it tells us is that there's sort of a mix of liberal and illiberal traditions enmeshed in our politics, right? So when you think about the United States, you have to recognize the fact that we are a nation premised on native dispossession and settlement, enriched through the stolen labor of human beings as property. So white democracy was legally sanctioned, and it was part of things like Indian removal, black codes, the Chinese Exclusion Act, segregated Mexican schools, Japanese internment, racially exclusive housing covenants, all these things, Jim Crow in the South, Juan Crow in the Southwest. And so that history is that for the majority of, you know, our country's history, white supremacy was not just sort of culturally acceptable, but it was legally authorized, right? Racial discrimination was de facto in that way. They had the legal right to deny equal rights to non-white subjects. And so I think that mix of sort of having access, that white citizens had access to the key components of constitutional liberalism, that they themselves had the experience of the rule of law and civil and political rights and civil liberties, yet this form of liberalism was in a symbiotic relationship to white supremacy. And I think that's the kind of dynamic that we haven't thought nearly enough about and the legacies of that complicated dynamic.
But of course, in our current politics, this complicated dynamic of our national legacies, of self-governance on the one hand, and of course, of oppression and exclusion on the other, become much less complicated and actually far more stark in one important place. And that's our southern border. Here again is Christina Beltran.
We are a multiracial democracy by law, but migrants being non-citizens become a population where you can still enact and practice these sort of extrajudicial as well as legally sanctioned violence against a population. That meeting of the extrajudicial and the legal is very potent and powerful, that you can dress up as a militia member and then go hunt migrants at the border, right? As well as pursue very harsh deportation and immigration policies. That combination makes people feel like something is being done about immigration. It makes people feel efficacious and agentic and powerful.
That language, hunting migrants at the border, Dorian, the phrase made me think of those horrifying images we saw just last month. Those of Border Patrol agents on horseback using riding crops against Haitian migrants at the border. And in September, here on The Takeaway, we talked with Jen Budd. Now, Jen is a former Border Patrol agent who now works as an immigrants' rights advocate. And here's part of what she said.
The things that are done in the name of national security, which actually has nothing to do with national security, are human rights violations, and they're brutal and they are cruel.
In July 2019, the New York Times dramatized the brutality and cruelty of the Trump-era policy of separating minor children from their parents at the border. And they dramatized this with a video editorial of American children reading from the testimonies given by migrant children being held in Customs and Border Protection facilities without their parents.
I'm so hungry that I've woken up in the middle of the night with hunger. I'm too scared to ask the officials for any more food.
There isn't water or soap to wash our hands after we use the bathroom. We have to ask for toilet paper if we want any.
My sister and I hold a blanket up for one another so no one can see us go to the bathroom.
Agents separated me from my dad. I have not seen my father again.
The stories from these children are absolutely heartbreaking. But this is not just about emotion alone. Because at the center of our conversation today is our longtime friend, Professor Christina Beltran. And like the two of us, Melissa, Professor Beltran is a political scientist. And she recently authored Cruelty as Citizenship, How Migrant Suffering Sustains White Democracy. And wow, Melissa, she has us thinking about the ways, the many ways that cruelty is used to define American citizenship and mark boundaries that are both figurative and literal. And nowhere, nowhere is this more obvious than in U.S. policy and practice at our southern border.
In 2019, ProPublica exposed a secret Facebook group where there were current and former Border Patrol agents. About somehow like around 9,500 members were sharing all these xenophobic and sexist memes and, you know, making fun of migrant death. And so it really speaks to the fact that, you know, the Border Patrol in terms of both who they recruit, the limited training, the kind of broad-based recruitment they do where they don't do a lot of vetting in order to grow the Border Patrol. You know, this organization was founded on a certain assumption about how you were supposed to keep Mexicans, both Mexican migrants, but Mexicans, Mexican Americans in their place in states like Texas. So in the same way that as we trace out the history of policing in the United States, and you can mm-hmm. tie that history of policing to the Black Codes, and you can start to see that our sort of carceral practices actually have this long history tied to earlier moments that we often don't really want to look directly at. And so we need to think about the fact that, you know, it is, who is it recruiting? Who is it drawing in? Who is being drawn into the politics of domination? And so I think, you know, one of those elements that I think is so interesting are sort of two things. One is that something like, you know, over half of Border Patrol are themselves Latinx. Mm-hmm. So that is a very interesting fact, the fact that people are being drawn to these, not necessarily in the same way that the police in this country are a multiracial population as well. We have a lot of non-white police officers, and that doesn't stop policing from being a violent practice. So, you know, one thing the book is trying to really do is to not just think about whiteness as white people, but think about whiteness itself as a practice of domination, and that that is something that other non-white populations can also find pleasure in. There's pleasure and a feeling of being, you know, powerful in that.
All right, I want to pause for just a second here, because when Christina said that, I found it really provocative and challenging. And so I did what we do on Deep Dive. I went to see if there's any data. And it turns out that in 2020, the Political Research Quarterly published a scholarly article by Professor David Cortez. And he is actually writing here about the fact that 30% of ICE officers and nearly half of all Border Patrol agents are Latinx. So what Professor Cortez did was a series of in-depth interviews with dozens of Latinx workers in these jobs. And his data show pretty clearly that, quote, agents overwhelmingly cited money, a stable good job, and benefits as their primary motivations for seeking out and accepting jobs at immigration. And I just thought that was really important to put here, because I know that part of what Christina is doing is suggesting for us the ways that being in the Border Patrol or in immigration might be about domination, about cruelty. But I also want to point out that there's at least some evidence here that it may also be simply about economic self-interest and survival, rather than about a desire to dominate or exclude. But maybe, honestly, maybe there's some cruelty in a system that forces people to make their living by being cruel. And we're going to talk more about that right after this break.
Every memory you think you have of the past.
The house you grew up in. Your first kiss.
It's not simply an idea. It's a physical trace left in your brain.
I own those memories. They define me.
But what happens when those memories are stolen from you?
In the blink of an eyelid.
Can you imagine what to have one night 20 years long? That's what it's been like. Just like death.
Memory and Forgetting on Radiolab. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
It's The Takeaway. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry, and I'm back along with my co-host, Dorian Warren, revisiting a conversation we had about 2 years ago. Now, this was when we introduced The Takeaway Deep Dive series, and we did it with an extended exploration of political cruelty. Before the break, I was suggesting maybe it's cruel that people have to work in Border Patrol simply to have economic security.
Yeah. And at the same time, Melissa, it's worth remembering that regardless of the reasons a person takes a job, the job itself can make people more cruel. And let me just say that again. The job itself can make people more cruel. Institutions built on a foundation of cruelty, guess what? They reproduce cruelty. And the most famous example in social science is the 1971 Stanford Prison Experiment.
Yo, I totally remember that.
We learned about it in grad school. We taught this for years. It was supposed to be a two-week study to understand how situational factors affect human behavior. Now, there were 24 students in the study, all of them white, all of them male, all of them enrolled at Stanford University. And the researchers randomly assigned some to be guards and some to be prisoners. They set up a fake jail in the basement of the psychology building. Prisoners were subjected to a variety of humiliating procedures, like late night awakenings, forced punishments, including push-ups or solitary confinement in a small empty broom closet. But the key takeaway is this, that on the fifth day of the experiment, the so-called guards became so abusive and the so-called prisoners became so traumatized that researchers had to shut down the whole study. Now, here's what one of the guards in the study said 2 months after the experiment concluded.
I had really thought that I was incapable of this kind of behavior. I was surprised, I was dismayed that I could act in a manner so absolutely unaccustomed to anything I would even really dream of doing. And while I was doing it, I didn't feel any regret. I didn't feel any guilt. It was only afterwards when I began to reflect on what I had done that this behavior began to dawn on me, and I realized that this was part of me I hadn't really noticed before.
It's wild. I mean, we're talking about 5 days. Mm. And this is an institution that's not really an institution, right? It's just a shadow, like, or a projection of a real system of cruelty. Dorian, you bringing up this Stanford prison study and its results, it makes me think back to where we began with Christina Beltran when she was talking about the displays of public cruelty at rallies for Donald Trump.
This is an invasion. When you see these caravans starting out with 20,000 people, that's an invasion.
A few days ago, I called the fake news the enemy of the people, and they are. They are the enemy of the people.
And certainly, there's something here about this shared pleasure and cruelty. And I'm thinking, isn't it also possible that institutional cruelty has done the same thing to us as a nation? That part of what we're seeing at these rallies has to be understood in that context of a political and economic systems that have persisted for decades, even centuries, with cruelty at their foundation.
Yeah, Melissa, we have to remember that walls and cruelly policed borders are just one part of our national civic cruelty towards immigrants. Consider continued deportations, particularly of Haitian migrants, or consider barbaric conditions in immigrant detention centers, or continued separation of migrant kids from their parents, or frankly, the use of an obscure public health order called Title 42, that frankly, both the Trump and Biden administrations have used to deport over 1 million migrants since the start of COVID-19.
I'm starting to feel a little low. So instead of going on, let's take a quick break. We're going to be back with my deep diving partner, Dorian Warren, in just a moment, and we will continue our discussion of political cruelty. We're back with The Takeaway. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry, and we're here with Dorian Warren. He's been with me this whole hour, and we've been talking about political cruelty. And Dorian, especially at the end, as you were really sort of laying out this particular forms of policy cruelty, I'm just kind of wondering, like, how are you feeling in this kind of brutal space we've made here?
It's a lot. And, you know, Melissa, if you're just a human being or you're anyone who's been marginalized or excluded or bullied in some way, or you just take a minute to tap into your own well of empathy for the suffering of others brought on, let me be clear, not by individual, but by collective cruelty through our policies, then it's really hard to not feel completely overwhelmed.
And yet I don't want us or our listeners to feel completely overwhelmed. I don't want to leave this deep dive with all of us still so far beneath the surface, like drowning in cruelty, that we feel unable to breathe. So let's look for a little bit of a lifeline back up to some sense of hope in the midst of all this meanness. And I will say that Professor Christina Beltran did offer us a little bit of that glimpse during our conversation with her. This is not a perfect situation. We still have, you know, dynamics of race and racism to grapple with. But you're seeing more and more white Americans saying, becoming appalled and aware of white democracy and wanting to reject and move away from it and claim something better. And so to me, I think that's actually one reason why things feel so divided and partisan right now, is because the overall majority consensus around the acceptance of whiteness and white democracy has collapsed. And white nativists can't even trust other white people to support them. And that frustration, that feeling that whiteness itself isn't holding, is partly the rage. I mean, think about the rage. They are going after other white citizens, other white political officials in their rage. So this is about, you know, a changing dynamic of how we identify, how we imagine ourselves as a collective. And that means it can change. The 2020 election, I think, showed us that we're the majority, that there are more of us, more people who believe in some sort of future of democracy. It's a popular front. It's a coalition of people with lots of different views. but it is a group that can grow. So I think going forward, I think we all have to fight for a multiracial democracy. We have to understand the history of white democracy and why people are attached to it, but then we have to fight like hell and organize together and build a larger multiracial majority. So I think the work ahead of us is hard, but it's also exciting because I think that it means that I can go into any community and make a case for why we could build something better and more beautiful. I think that's the work of this moment.
The work of this moment. How do you not despair in the face of cruelty, and especially civic and political cruelty? Melissa, how do you ensure then the darkest moments that hope dies last, in the words of Studs Terkel? And Professor Beltran reminds us of the North Stars of imagination, what some would call freedom dreams, and of course, of collective action, resistance to the cruelty, and organizing to build a just multiracial democracy. And it's a freedom dream expressed so powerfully by Amanda Gorman, the inaugural poet from this year, in her piece, This Hill We Climb.
Even as we grieved, we grew, that even as we hurt, we hoped, that even as we tired, we tried, that we'll forever be tied together, victorious. Not because we will never again know defeat, but because we will never again sow division.
Not because we will never again know defeat, but because we will never again
sow division.
Whew, so this hill we climb, Melissa, requires a really robust notion of, let's call it linked fate, how all of our fates are linked together. Of, you know, I think of the terms, the concepts of mutuality and solidarity towards our future. That's how we keep hope alive.
Empathy, mutuality, solidarity, linked fate, and never again sowing division. Dorian Warren is co-president of Community Change, co-chair of the Economic Security Project, and he is my partner and co-host for the Deep Dives here on The Takeaway. Thank you for joining us, Dorian.
Always great to be with you, Melissa.